Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nimi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about what Ice Age extinctions tell us about the future of today's large mammals with Sharon Levy, author of Once and Future Giants. Scientists have long debated whether prehistoric people drove large Ice Age animals to extinction. In her book, Once and Future Giants, Sharon looks at the lives of these long-lost giants and uncovers strong parallels between their fate and the plight of modern wildlife. She also asserts that by understanding the die-offs of the Ice Age megamammals, we'll have a better chance to help today's megafauna avoid the same fate. As you'll hear, North America was home to a menagerie of massive mammals, like mammoths, mastodons, camels, giant beavers, sloths, and lions, until about 13,000 years ago, when the first humans reached the Americas. Levy will introduce us to many of these fantastic creatures and talk about how they relate to today's elephants, bears, and other animals. She'll also examine their extinctions and compare them to the threats faced by elephants, bears, and other species today. She notes similarities in the role played by these large mammals in the ecosystem, and also notes a major difference, mainly that today's megafauna are trapped in islands of habitat. Sharon Levy is a writer who specializes in making the science behind natural resource and conservation issues come alive for a general audience. For the past 19 years, she's covered environmental issues of all kinds, including the ecology of top predators, bioengineered mosquitoes, and archaeological evidence of ancient human impacts on wildlife and fisheries. Sharon is a contributing editor at On Earth magazine and writes regularly for National Wildlife, Bioscience, Audubon, and The New Scientist. Her work has also appeared in Natural History, Nature, Wildlife Conservation, High Country News, and Discovery Channel Online. She's also the author of the new book, Once and Future Giants, What Ice Age Extinctions Tell Us About the Fate of Earth's Largest Animals, which we'll talk about today. When I talked to Sharon, I asked her what got her interested in the Ice Age and its mega mammals.
I think what really drew me to this topic, I grew up in Chicago, and I was a very frustrated kid because I wanted to be out in the wild. And there I was, you know, just in this concrete canyon all the time. And I went to the Field Museum, and I saw this mounted skeleton of a mastodon. And I realized, my God, these incredible giants used to be right here in my neighborhood. So as a kid, I used to fantasize that all these dead mastodons that were buried under the pavement would just kind of rise up and run down Lakeshore Drive and cause a big panic. So I had longstanding fantasies about Ice Age megafauna. And then, much more recently, back in the late 90s, I began to report on some scientists who were studying what happened to the last of these Ice Age giants and why they disappeared. And some of these folks even shared my dreams of resurrecting some of the giants. So I really felt like I had to write about it.
Can you describe some of the megafauna of the Ice Age? You know, which were the ones that sort of captured your imagination most? You mentioned the mastodons. Can you describe the mastodons? Let's start with that.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to put the mastodon a bit in context for you. In Ice Age America, there were 7 different species of elephants. And the mastodon was dominant in the east. It was what's called a browser, which means it ate shrubs and trees. It had great big molars with cusps on them, like our molars do. And a mastodon molar, if you go visit a paleontologist and get to pick up a mastodon molar, and they weigh 10, 15 pounds. They're gigantic.
Just a single molar.
One tooth from one of these animals. And so they were really, the mastodons were shorter than the mammoths. There was also a very common mammoth in what's now the lower 48 states called the Columbian mammoth, and it was the tallest American elephant. It stood about 14 feet high at the shoulder. And mastodons were shorter, but they were stockier, so they might have been just about as heavy as this much taller mammoth. And they were kind of shaggy. They had big tusks.
And were the mammoths shaggy as well?
Well, there were different kinds of mammoths. There was the woolly mammoth, which lived in the far north, which was incredibly cold during the Ice Age. And they were very shaggy and well-insulated, so they could survive the extreme cold of living in the far north. But the Columbian mammoth was not shaggy. It lived in the lower 48, where there were warmer conditions, and it was probably more like a modern elephant, a little bit of fur, not a whole lot.
And the mastodon, you said, was shorter than the Columbian mammoth.
Right. You know, they were probably a few feet shorter.
And fatter? Stockier?
Yeah, sort of, they were big-boned. They were big-boned elephants. Not that all elephants aren't big-boned, but the mastodon more so than the...
So they didn't live in the age of the supermodel. The supermodel elephant.
No, they would not have been. Yeah, and the other reason I did the book was I heard that Madonna was going to run a line of mastodon lingerie, and I wanted to ride the wave.
So there were seven, you said there were seven species of elephant in Ice Age America, and you mentioned the Columbian mammoth, the woolly mammoth, and the mastodon.
Right.
And there were others, too?
There were others, and I know that in Central and South America there were a couple different varieties of gomphotheres, which was an elephant that was closely related to the mastodon, but it was distinct enough that it was considered a separate species, and it lived farther south.
All of those elephant species were browsers?
No, the mammoths were grazers, which means they relied mostly on eating grass, and that's why their teeth are very different from mastodon teeth. So if you go to your local museum, if they have a good exhibit on Ice Age animals, or Pleistocene era animals. Pleistocene is just the fancy scientific lingo for the Ice Age. A lot of these exhibits will show you a molar of a mammoth, which is kind of flat with little ridges on it, next to the molar of a mastodon, which has these great big cusps. So they did have different eating strategies, and they probably hung out in really different habitats. The mammoths were more grassland creatures, and the mastodons within the woodland.
Who were their compatriots?
Yes, they, these mammoths and mastodons lived in an Ice Age America that was just teeming with amazing creatures. I really think America at that time would make the modern Serengeti look sedate. So there were great herds of camel and horse. Camels and horses first evolved in the Americas. And they were very common throughout the Ice Age.
So camels, too.
Yeah.
I mean, we always think of camels as a very desert, you know, Middle Eastern animal.
Yeah, but they evolved right here in America. And there have been many finds of their fossil bones at the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles and at other well-known fossil sites. And there was a really neat creature. It was a great big herbivore called the giant ground sloth. And the sloth was basically, it was a vegetarian, but I think it would have been very frightening to encounter because these creatures were just built like tanks. And
how big were they? About the size of a tank?
Well, when the tallest of them reared up on its hind legs, which they were designed to do because they seem to have been designed to forage for leaves pretty high up in trees, and so they probably reared up on their hind legs pretty often, reaching up into trees. And when they did that, the tallest of them would have stood as tall as a Columbian mammoth.
Wow.
So they were very impressive animals, and they're hard to imagine because there's really nothing in the modern world quite like them. Their closest living relatives are the small tree sloths that live in Central and South America. But that's, you know, it's a pretty drastic difference in scale. between these little tree sloths and these great lumbering ground sloths that used to be all over the Americas. And then, of course, since there were all these large herbivores on the hoof, there were a bunch of amazing predators around taking advantage of that situation. And my personal favorite predator is the saber-toothed cat.
And what was that like? Is that what we think of as a saber-toothed tiger? Or it's different?
Yeah, I mean, that's what, if your kids have seen those Ice Age, animated Ice Age movies.
Right. Who hasn't at this point?
Right, we've all been exposed at this point. Yeah, there's a saber-toothed, they call him a saber-toothed tiger. But there were actually several different species of saber-toothed cat. So there were some different varieties, but what distinguished them was that they had these huge dagger-like stabbing canine teeth, and the teeth were so long that the animal's jaw had to be built to drop wide open like a trap door to make room for these canine teeth. And the teeth are amazing. I met one researcher who's got a 25,000-year-old saber-toothed canine lying on his desk, and it's still razor sharp. He didn't do anything to it. It just was preserved very well. It's razor sharp, and he opens his letters with it.
How big is the canine? How big is that tooth? Like the size of my hand? The length of my hand?
Almost, I would say it's at least 10 inches long.
Wow.
And it's curved, so that's from, you know, the base to the tip, maybe 10 inches long. And some of them would have been longer even. And I'm fascinated by the saber-toothed cats because there's great evidence from the La Brea site in Los Angeles that saber-tooths were social animals. And we know that because at La Brea, where many of these animals fell into, La Brea is basically a natural tar seep, so it's like a great big swamp of gooey petroleum. And it's a great fossil site because all these different animals wandered in there and got stuck in the goo and died and were perfectly preserved. So there were many saber-tooths found at La Brea, and a lot of them had suffered serious broken bones during their lives and then lived on for a long time. And that would only be possible if their families took care of them while they got better. And we also know that saber-tooths had made a habit out of preying on young mammoths. They could not tackle a grown mammoth, but they would go after the babies.
So how do you know that they went after the babies?
Because there are sites where there are cave sites where there were lots of remains of saber-tooths and their dinners. And you could tell that saber-tooths had killed young mammoths and that there were young mammoth bones laying around in this cave, but never grown-up bones because those animals were just too hard to tackle.
And you said that there were several species of saber-toothed cats. Do we know a lot about the different species?
Well, paleontologists do. I don't know about them in detail. There's a family. It's called Smilodon, which is just a cool Latin name.
I don't know that I'd be smiling, though, when I met these.
No, they were probably really terrifying for a person to encounter. But they all fell into that pattern of the really long stabbing teeth and the sort of family lifestyle and the tendency to attack young mammoths. And also, you know, they would prey on horses and camels and whatnot, too.
Do other cats in the modern world, like lions and or tigers, have that same family structure? Where, I mean, you see them in prides and whatnot, but or at least lions, you see them in prides, but
right.
Where, is there evidence that when someone suffered a broken bone, they do get cared for and get better?
Well, most big cats in the modern world are not social, and the African lion is the exception because they live in prides and they take care of each other. But interestingly, in Ice Age America, We have lions, and in genetic terms, they are the same species that still lives in Africa.
Really?
Yes. But the American lions of the Pleistocene were 25% larger than the living African lions. So if you go to the museum at La Brea and see a mountain skeleton of one of these gigantic cats, and even though they're inert bones, they are scary.
So you don't want to have them come alive like in, Night at the Museum or something?
No, probably not. I haven't caught Night at the Museum. I mean, in a way, you'd love to have them come alive because it would be such a thrill, but I'd like to have something between me and them.
So there were lions in America, in Ice Age America.
That's right.
That were larger than African lions, but genetically...
Genetically, very, very close.
Very
genetically the same species. We also had another big cat in Pleistocene America. We had an American, it's called the American cheetah-like cat, and some folks just call it the American cheetah. It's actually not genetically very closely related to the African cheetah at all, but it was built very much like an African cheetah. And it seems to have evolved to hunt pronghorns, which we still have in the American West. And the pronghorn runs so fast that no living land predator can catch it, at least not when it's an adult.
This cheetah-like cat, American cheetah-like cat, was able to successfully prey on pronghorns?
Yeah, but it certainly was designed to do so, and there's some fossil evidence. And really, just the existence of the pronghorn is an argument for it. It's the pronghorn is like the equivalent of, say, the African springbok that just runs incredibly quick and is designed to get away from cheetahs. And it's, these animals like springboks and cheetahs can run about 60 miles an hour. So that's really way faster than any living predator that we have in the Americas now. But that American cheetah was actually closely related to the cougar, the species we still have living with us.
But the cougars aren't as fast as this one?
No, not nearly.
What morphologically makes you know that they were faster than cougars?
Well, morphologically, they're just built like a cheetah, so they have these long hind limbs. And if you just look at a picture of an African cheetah, you can get the idea. They're very sleek and long-limbed, and just more streamlined than a cougar. Although I've been lucky enough to see a cougar running in the wild, and that's extremely impressive, too.
So tell me more about all the predators.
We had American lions and American cheetahs. We had gray wolves in Ice Age America, the same kind of wolves that we now have in Alaska and in Yellowstone National Park area. But there was also another species of wolf called the dire wolf that was really not taller than a modern gray wolf, but stockier, like the mastodon was stocky. It was kind of a heavy-duty wolf.
What made it stocky? Why did the mastodon and why did this dire wolf need to be stockier? Because of the cold?
Maybe because of the cold. And I don't really have a set answer to that. There is a general principle in ecology that creatures tend to get larger at higher latitudes, just because if you live in a cold environment, it's advantageous to have a large body. It's easier to maintain your internal body temperature if you're big. So it's easier to stay warm if you're an elephant than if you're a mouse. The concept is you want your surface area to body mass ratio to be right for the climate you live in. So if you're a small creature, you're kind of like a hummingbird where they're just incredibly high metabolism. They eat all the time. And it would be hard for them to survive in cold climates. And in fact, they don't. You don't find hummingbirds in the Arctic. but you find bigger creatures up there.
And then African elephants. I mean, it does get cold in a lot of African countries.
The surviving elephants, which, by the way, are not descendants of these lost mammoths and mastodons. They're cousins, and they were contemporaries. There were, you know, the modern African and Asian elephants existed during the Pleistocene. But they're, I mean, today they're restricted to pretty much the tropics. And while some people dream of introducing them to the Americas to stand in for the lost American elephants, it's a real question whether they can handle the colder climate on the Great Plains, for instance.
What about beavers or rodents and things?
Well, there was, in Pleistocene America, there was this incredible giant beaver. It stood as tall as a bear.
Really?
Yes. if you can imagine that. So I've often tried to imagine what the lodge of a beaver the size of a bear would have looked like.
You can only imagine what kind of engineering these bear-sized beavers would do on the streams.
Right. But there were also, you know, there were smaller, you know, little voles and mice and rats and things that we're accustomed to also live during the Pleistocene.
Why does your book, Once and Future Giants, focus on the larger mammals?
The reason my book focuses on large animals is that there's this very striking trend in the fossil record that in the late Pleistocene, lots of large animals disappeared forever. And that pattern doesn't really appear among the smaller species.
Why did those animals disappear?
Well, that's the big question. So there's different theories about why they disappeared. Up until about three decades ago, the standing idea among most scientists who study this was that they all died out as victims of climate change. And the basic argument for that went along these lines. It was the close of the Ice Age, and the glaciers were receding, and temperatures were rising very fast. And when that happens, vegetation patterns tend to change very quickly, too. So that might have made it much harder for large vegetarians like mammoths and sloths and camels to find enough food to eat. And if all these large vegetarians began to fade away, then the big predators that relied on them would start to dwindle, too. But there is a hang-up with that argument. And the hang-up is that the Pleistocene era, also known as the Ice Age, it was really a whole series of different ice ages. So the Pleistocene was more than 2 million years long. And during that time, the climate cycled over and over again between really peaks of coldness, peaks of glaciation, when there were glaciers as far south as modern-day Oregon or modern-day Spain. And then at the other extreme, there were really warm times when the climate was not much different from the climate we know today. And all these large animals had survived these repeated warm spells in America and around the world. And in America, they survived all the warm spells up until that last one, which happened about 13,000 years ago. So the glitch in the idea that it was just climate was that, in terms of climate, that last warming spell was not different from the previous ones. But what struck some researchers, especially a guy named Paul Martin, was that 13,000 years ago, at the moment all these large animals went extinct in the Americas, was also when this culture of Stone Age hunters fanned out across the whole continent. And we know that they hunted megafauna.
But of course they didn't hunt megafauna exclusively. Or did they?
No, they did what they needed to do to get by, and they ate what they could get. But there's a very dramatic pattern that really dominated the study of this culture, which is called Clovis culture, after the town of Clovis, New Mexico, where the first implements of this kind of stone tool were found. And the striking pattern was that they're these very distinctive and they're very elegant stone spear points. They're beautiful, like they're like works of art. They're shaped like leaves, and they've got what's called fluting, which was a new invention, which helped them to attach the spearhead to a wooden spear. And these very distinctive, elegant stone tools have been found left among the bones of mammoths and mastodons at kill sites that were scattered all the way from Arizona to Maine, and they all date to this narrow window of time, 13,000 years ago. So that was a very impressive pattern, and that led Paul Martin, who was at the time a maverick and got nothing but ribbing from his colleagues for this idea, but he, as early as the 1950s, put forth the idea that Clovis people just wiped out America's megafauna.
That's because they were everywhere and they were hunting. That was the big difference, is that you had more people hunting in more places.
Well, Martin believed, and at the time he had a lot of company in this belief, that Clovis people were the very first humans in the Americas. And so Martin's idea was that the ancestors of Clovis, the people who were about to become Clovis, came across the Bering Land Bridge, and they kind of stumbled into North America and found this whole continent teeming with naive giant animals who'd never seen a human and didn't know how to react to a human hunter. And so in Martin's vision of what happened, the Clovis people just slaughtered their way across the whole continent, and he himself described this as the Blitzkrieg theory. And, you know, I'll say up front that in a lot of ways his Blitzkrieg theory seems impossible. But there are points in his Blitzkrieg theory that have really shaped the way people understand this mass extinction at the end of the Ice Age.
And what are those points that you pull out that make a lot of sense?
Well, Martin had this vision of, as I said, of the Clovis people as the very first people and sort of exploiting the naivete of the native wildlife here in the Americas. And that doesn't hold up. I mean, at this point in time, there's plenty of evidence that there were humans in the Americas before Clovis time. But as far as we can tell, they were scattered little groups of people, and it wasn't one coherent culture. You don't find, prior to the moment of Clovis culture, there's no one kind of technology that you find all across the continent. You know, Martin put forth this theory, and when I met him, he was a very charming, funny man, and he told me, yes, I got lots of ribbing for my theory, but I didn't care. I like a theory that goes way out on a limb and sees how long it can hang there. So, I would say some points of his theory have fallen off the branch. The idea that Clovis was first, the idea that they could have exploited the naivete of these wildlife for very long. I mean, elephants and these other animals are not stupid. They would have figured it out. And there's evidence from studies of modern wildlife that it doesn't take long. For instance, if you study elk in an area where there were no wolves and then wolves are brought back, the elk don't take too long to figure out how to be careful around a wolf, you know. So I think that part of his theory has fallen off the branch. But what has never really faded away is his core argument that human beings played a significant role in the extinctions. And that has really changed the way a lot of scientists view this whole issue.
Given that humans likely played a role in the extinctions, that's primarily due to the hunting pressure?
In the Americas, we know that they did hunt. And there's also evidence that it was a very dry time, that as the climate was warming, the environment became much drier. And for instance, every known elephant kill in the Americas, every known elephant kill that there's good evidence was done by humans, has been found right at a water source. So that suggests that the mammoths and mastodons were restricted to little oases where they could get to water, and that would have made them easier targets for human hunters to get at. So in the Americas, the evidence points to human hunting as kind of an added stress at a time when the animals would have already been stressed by rapid climate change. But there have also been extinctions in other parts of the world where people seem to have impacted the animals in other ways. In Australia, for instance, there's a fascinating theory that the earliest people in Australia, who arrived about 50,000 years ago, really altered the landscape by setting fires, and that they altered the landscape so much that that drove the Australian megafauna into extinction.
Really?
Yeah.
You had noted in your book, Once and Future Giants, about some of the various forensic evidence related to dung and teeth that reinforce this theory. Can you take me through some of that evidence?
Okay, let's start with the dung.
It's always good to start there.
Well, it turns out that lots of the science related to both the extinct megafauna and sometimes the living megafauna ends up dealing with analyzing dung. And one of the first scientists I connected with who got me interested in this issue is a guy named Guy Robinson, who's a paleontologist at Fordham University. And he went into the Ice Age record of what happened in New York State. And the way he did this was by going to boggy places in the Hudson River Valley, and he would take a great big auger and dig through places where he could find undisturbed peat. And the peat was laid down as the glaciers receded towards the end of the Ice Age. And so I got to go in the field with him, which was lots of fun, and watch him drill way down into the dirt in this little piece of undisturbed forest in the Hudson River Valley. And when he got down deep enough, he knows the layers, he's been doing this a long time, when he got down deep enough, he pulled out a bunch of wetland plants that were about 14,000 years old, but they were really well preserved, and they looked just like soggy cattails you would see in a wetland today. And he handed this stuff to me and he said, this could have been mastodon fodder. So what he did was he went back through this ancient record that's in the dirt, and he didn't need bones. He looked back at pieces of fossil pollen and other fossil plant parts. And he also tracked a species of fungus called Sporomyela, which only grows in the dung of large vegetarian animals like elephants or elk. And he was able to show that there's a sequence that's all very close together in time where the level of dung spores in the ancient soil in the Hudson River Valley crashes, which implies that the number of large vegetarians went way down. And then right afterwards, there's a lot more charcoal deposited in the ground. And so the way he reads this story is that the first human hunters came into the New York area, and they started hunting megafauna. It really tipped the balance and lowered the populations of large vegetarians. And then when that happened, there was a lot more growth of brush because there weren't mastodons and mammoths around and other large vegetarians eating this stuff. And so when humans lit fires, which hunter-gatherer peoples have always done, they would have created landscape fires that were much bigger than they'd been in the past. So that's one message from the dung, so to speak.
Interesting. That's fascinating. All that from a little...
All that from microscopic spores that used to live in dung thousands of years ago. It's pretty amazing.
And has that theory borne out? Is that...
Well, there's a very similar pattern that's been found in other parts of the country. So Guy Robinson collaborated with some other researchers who analyzed sediments from a pond in Indiana, and they found a very, very similar pattern, and it's all but about the same moment in time, that the dung spores from large vegetarian megafauna disappear, and then there's a lot more charcoal right afterwards. So it does seem to be a pattern that exists, and it's been seen in the West too, although the timing is a little bit different. But the pattern holds up.
What about teeth? That was another evidence that you cite in Once and Future Giants.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of amazing evidence from teeth, and most of it arises from the work of one very brilliant paleontologist, Dan Fisher. He's at the University of Michigan. And he spent about 30 years teaching himself to analyze the life stories of mammoths and mastodons by examining their tusks in incredible detail. And so he's been able to tell, for instance, there's a female mastodon that's mounted in the museum at University of Michigan, and he was able to tell me her life story in really heartbreaking detail. And he knows it all because he found it in her tusk. And the reason he was able to understand what happened during the course of her life is that elephant tusks, they're the elephant version of incisor teeth. And all of us have a pair of incisor teeth. But in elephants, the incisor tooth, the tusk, grows throughout the animal's life. And if you slice through the tusk the way you might slice through a banana, you get a disc of ivory that's lined with growth rings, kind of like the growth rings you see if you slice through a tree trunk. So by analyzing subtle variations in these growth lines, Fisher can tell a lot of what happened during the animal's life. And in the case of this one female, the Owosomastodon, which is mounted at the museum in Michigan, he knows that she gave birth for the first time when she was 10 years old, that the first baby survived, but that over the next few years of her life, she had three more infants, and all of them died before they reached the age of 1 year. And Owosso was one of the very last of her kind. And evidence like this about the pattern of her life suggests that she was living during a time when mastodons were experiencing heavy hunting pressure.
Can you explain that further? I mean, it could have just been that there were a lot of predators then.
Let me put together this story for you. Fisher not only looks at the mastodon tusks, he also looks at information on the biology of living elephants, which has been gathered by researchers who are studying elephants in Africa and Asia. So one interesting factoid is that Owosso lost more of her babies than most African elephant mothers in Africa, even those that live in places where there's still a serious poaching problem. But there's a broader pattern that Fisher found in tusks of mastodons from the last 2,000 years that the species existed. So this is the last 2,000 years of the Ice Age. And over that span of time, the age of puberty in mastodons dropped. So at the beginning of that time, they would become sexually mature when they were about 13. At the end of the time, they were becoming sexually mature, as the Owosomastodon did, when they were 10. And that pattern is very telling because there's research on all kinds of creatures, from fish to elephants, that shows that when there's heavy hunting pressure, the animals will start to mature earlier, which just gives them a better chance to reproduce before they get hunted down. So right at the same window of time that the Clovis people come on the scene, there's evidence that mastodons were experiencing a real increase in hunting pressure. So this is all inference, and of course, unless someone invents a time machine, we can't say exactly what happened for sure, but it's all very suggestive.
So the variations in the growth lines can tell us when she got pregnant and weaning and puberty and
right.
All that. And,
right. The way that works is, And this works not only in females, but in males. In male elephants, and there's very good evidence of this in mammoth and mastodon tusks as well, but in modern male elephant society, when the males go through puberty, they get kicked out of their family herd. So they get raised when they're kids by their mothers and aunts and grandmothers. And then when they become sexually mature, the moms and aunts kick them out because it's just not okay to have a sexually mature male hanging around. And so the first year after this happens is a very lean time for a young male elephant because he's been relying on the adult females to keep him, you know, to find good food and keep him safe. And some young guys don't even make it through their first year or two on their own. But the ones who do, their growth lines get narrower because they're not finding as much food, and so they don't have as much energy to put into growing their tusk. The same kind of pattern shows up in a female when she's pregnant or nursing because she's channeling her energy and her nutrients into growing or feeding her baby.
And then that narrow, while she's pregnant and feeding the baby, it's narrow, and then you can tell that she lost the baby because it gets wider after
that.
That's
right, yeah.
What does that all say about today? What can we learn from these Ice Age extinctions about today's large mammals?
I think there's some very important parallels, and that they're clearest. I think, for instance, the last of the mastodons, like Owosso, form almost a mirror image of the threatened elephants in Africa and Asia today. And there's a growing body of evidence that suggests what got the mastodons and the other large animals at the end of the Ice Age was a kind of 1-2 punch. So they were already stressed by climate change. And then humans came on the scene and tipped the balance by increasing hunting pressure. And the presence of human hunters is really the only obvious difference, as I mentioned, between that last warming spell 13,000 years ago and all the previous ones, which the giants had survived. Well, today, living megafauna, such as elephants, are trapped in little islands of habitat, and they're surrounded by people in our roads and our ranches and our cities. We know that Ice Age elephants survived times of extreme climate change by roaming over vast distances until they could find good forage, good habitat. Well, that's impossible in the modern world because we've usurped so much of the planet and made it impassable for these large animals. So one important lesson is that we need to give modern megafauna room to move. And people are actually acting on this and trying to create transboundary conservation areas. This is going on in Africa and in the Americas. And it's a simple concept, but it's very important that big animals always need a lot of space, but it's especially critical in a time like today when the climate is warming at a rate that has never been seen before in the entire evolutionary history of mammals. So the warming we have today with human-generated greenhouse gases is incredibly rapid, and we need to give them room to move to adapt to that. And the other obvious parallel is that we need to just give them a break from human hunting whenever we can. And that's certainly true of elephants, which, you know, are still often poached for their ivory, and of rhinos that are often poached for their horns, and tigers that are poached for their body parts. It's a very widespread common problem with a lot of endangered living animals.
So creating these transboundary parks to allow the migrations and ability to adapt is one solution. And then to prevent the hunting, wildlife law enforcement, reducing demand.
You know,
how do you give them a break, I guess? Take them to the spa. The elephant spa.
Yeah, that sounds nice. Well, you know, obviously there's no easy answer, especially in the third world where, you know, the people can be really poor and really desperate, and they're going to do whatever it takes. So in terms of protecting elephants, one of the major strategies has been to try to reduce demand by making trade in elephant ivory illegal. And that's helped some, but there's still a big black market in ivory. And there's also another aspect that I forgot to mention. The other lesson that I think we can get from studies of the Ice Age ecosystems of these giant animals and comparisons to modern ones is that megafauna of all kinds really shape the world around them. So, for instance, elephants really shape the vegetation around them because they feed on shrubbery and trees. And they actually can clear an area of trees, which allows grass to grow up, and that creates habitat for other kinds of megafauna, like zebras and giraffes. So that's been shown, that's a pattern that's well demonstrated in Africa, for instance, that Elephants come in, kind of clear an area out, turn it into grassland, and local people, like the Maasai people in Kenya and Tanzania, know this very well, and they'll actually follow the patterns of the wild animals to try to figure out where they should graze their cattle. It's not just the elephant, though. All kinds of large herbivores have an impact on their ecosystem by changing the balance between the vegetation they feed on and cycling nutrients into the soil so more plants can grow. But the really critical difference between then and now, I think, is that the Pleistocene world was full of big predators. And the predators really are important in maintaining some kind of balance between the herbivores and the plants. And what's going on in much of our modern world is that since humans don't tolerate large predators very well, is that the whole ecosystem is a bit out of whack because we've lost our large predators.
So that balance is not maintained.
Right. And if you look, for instance, at the history of gray wolves being brought back to the Yellowstone ecosystem, they were initially wiped out quite purposefully in the 1920s. And at the time, there had been a lot of market hunting of elk. And so the elk population was down. And wolves were starting to prey on livestock like sheep and calves. And so people felt like they just needed to get rid of wolves, and they did. The last wolf in the Yellowstone area was killed in the 20s, the 1920s. And then after much controversy, they were reintroduced. They brought some wolves down from Canada back to the Yellowstone area in 1995. And, of course, this was a great experiment in progress, and a lot of ecologists have tracked it very closely. And there's really a lot of evidence that when the wolf came back, the whole ecosystem in Yellowstone became more diverse and more resilient than it had been without wolves.
Tell me about that resiliency and the biodiversity.
By the time of, you know, the later part of the 20th century, the elk population had more than rebounded because the wolves were gone, and elk are the primary prey of wolves in that part of the world. So after decades with no wolves on the ground, the elk population was just tremendous. And the elk were basically devouring all the riparian plants. Riparian just means plants like cottonwood and alder that tend to grow along stream sides. And all these plants were just being devoured, and no new trees of these species were growing up at all because they would just get eaten up before they could mature. So after the wolves came back, wolves like to hang out along watercourses. And the elk very quickly figured out that it was starting to be very dangerous to hang out right near the creek. And so now, since the wolves are around, there's been a whole renaissance of the vegetation along these creeks. And with that has come a return of a lot of other species that were tied into that riparian vegetation. One example is the beaver. At the time the wolves were returned, there were essentially no beaver in Yellowstone. And they've come back. And talking to Doug Smith, the lead wolf biologist in the park, who's also studied beaver, he believes the northern range of Yellowstone now has as many beaver as it can support, which is a real radical change from 15 or so years ago. And the beaver, in turn, create more biodiversity because they create ponds when they build their lodges, and that makes habitat for chorus frogs and other critters that need that kind of still water that otherwise doesn't exist. So there's a real chain reaction. It's called a trophic cascade, and it affects species that you wouldn't think would be affected. Songbirds, for instance. Songbirds that like to nest in willow have started to come back because the willow are coming back. When there were no wolves, there were no new willows growing up, and all these other species were affected.
Oh, interesting. So for the lesson then for today's megafauna is that by actually facilitating their movement, you'd actually create a more resilient and diverse ecosystem.
I think, to me, the big take-home message is that large predators are really key to healthy ecosystems. And the wolf in Yellowstone really demonstrates that. So I don't have a handy answer because humans have been unhappy with large predators in their midst for millions of years. But my hope is that we can get better at coexisting with them because I think it really just shapes the natural world in important ways.
So we were just talking about reintroduction of wolves. So what would be the pros and cons of reintroducing some of these other species?
Well, there is a group of scientists who have proposed what they call Pleistocene rewilding. And they published a very famous and controversial paper in the journal Nature in 2005. And basically, the proposal they were making was that they wanted to bring endangered megafauna from the old world, like African lions and elephants, and put them in enclosed reserves on the Great Plains in America and see if they could act as ecological stand-ins for their lost Ice Age relatives. Needless to say, this was an extremely controversial idea, and there are a lot of flaws in it. But it's kind of like Martin's, and Paul Martin was involved in the rewilding proposal and really was the inspiration for it in many ways. But kind of like his earlier proposal of the Blitzkrieg theory, if you first look at it, at first glance, it may just look simply nuts. But there are, if you dig deeper, there is some real value to what comes up when you look at Pleistocene rewilding.
What is the value? Tell me more. You know, it creates a hardier, healthier ecosystem?
Well, I think, for instance, the idea of bringing African lions and elephants to the Great Plains, it's just unrealistic. I mean, people won't stand for it. And you couldn't really put them in enclosures because even a park as big as Kruger National Park in South Africa is having trouble because it gets overpopulated with elephants. And, you know, I think Kruger National Park is about the size of Massachusetts. So, you know, there's sort of political and human realities that just are impossible to overcome. And I don't think we can bring elephants or lions back. But there are humbler ways of applying the concept that I think can be really useful. So a couple of examples come from Australia and the island of Mauritius.
Tell me about some real-life cases of rewilding.
So Okay. Examples of real-world rewilding. To put it briefly, there's one obvious example in the American West, and that's the wild Mustang, wild horse. I mentioned that horses evolved here in the Americas, but at some point millions of years ago, they crossed the Bering Land Bridge and made their way into Asia, and they proceeded to evolve into all the old world forms of horse, all the zebras of Africa, and there's an Asian horse called the Przewalski's horse. There was once a wild European horse, the Tarpan, which is now extinct. But all the American horses went extinct 13,000 years ago, along with the mammoths and the saber-tooths. So when the conquistadors showed up in the 1500s and brought domestic horses with them, they committed an act of Pleistocene rewilding. So I decided to look at how that turned out, and in modern America, we still have a lot of Mustangs roaming free in the Great Basin, which is a big stretch of arid land between the Sierra Range in California and the Wasatch Mountains in Utah. And in one sense, these horses are incredibly successful. They're very well adapted to life here on their continent of origin, and their populations just boom, but for that very reason, they are an ecological disaster. Because the problem with horses in the modern West is they've lost their predators. Obviously, the saber-tooths, the other animals of the Pleistocene that were able to take on an animal the size of a horse, are long gone. And under current law, we're not allowed to hunt Mustangs the way we do elk, for instance. And so their populations just boom. And every year, the Bureau of Land Management has to round up what they call excess Mustangs. And they try to adopt them out to ranchers, but they never can find homes for all these animals. So in ecological terms, when the horse population booms, they devour all the forage in the wild, which has bad impacts on them and on other wildlife like bighorn sheep. So that example from the West might suggest that Pleistocene rewilding tends to be a disaster in the real world. But there's another example in Australia that would kind of give the opposite message. And that example is the dingo, which was introduced 4,000 years ago by sailors who came from Southeast Asia. And the dingo at that point was a barely domesticated form of the Indian wolf. And when it came ashore in Australia, it was quickly adopted by Aboriginal people there. But dingoes also went into the wild and did very well for themselves. And in modern Australia, there was a mass megafauna extinction down under during the Pleistocene. It happened about 45,000 years ago, a few thousand years after the first human settlement of Australia. So there was a whole array of giant kangaroos and huge wombat-like creatures with buck teeth and giant lizards and a marsupial lion. But they were all gone by the time the dingo showed up. And after Europeans arrived, they persecuted the dingo very intensely because dingoes would prey on sheep and calves. But the Europeans also brought in a bunch of other European animals, including the European fox and the house cat. And foxes and cats now prey very heavily on the few remaining native marsupial species down there, which tend to be small creatures, because the Pleistocene extinctions in Australia, like the ones in America, hit big animals and left the little ones behind. So there's a growing body of research in Australia that shows where there's a healthy dingo population, the dingoes scare off or hunt the cats and the foxes, and this allows the native wildlife to do much better. So the native wildlife, even the native plants, are more abundant and diverse where you have dingoes. And on the other extreme, places where people have succeeded in wiping dingoes out, which Australians have been trying to do for over 100 years, in those areas, a lot of native small mammals are going extinct.
So it might be useful to take a look at rewilding experiments, especially with looking at putting predators back into ecosystems where they'd been eviscerated.
Yeah, you know, as much as possible. I think that there's a strong argument for protecting the dingo, which is very controversial in Australia. In modern Australia, the dingo exists in this very weird legal limbo. It's a protected species in two states, and in the rest of the country, people are legally required to try to kill them. And the government is spending lots of money every year dropping poison baits from helicopters to try to kill dingoes. And yet, many ecologists are arguing that the most effective way to protect the remaining native wildlife of the country is to just let dingoes be. So I think in that case, you have a quote-unquote introduced animal, but it's been there for 4,000 years. And it is fulfilling a role, this role of the top predator, that's very important. So I think in those cases, the value of the Pleistocene rewilding idea is that hopefully it can just get people to open their minds. And instead of trying to return nature to what we think it was before Europeans hit any particular place, think more about the relationships in ecosystems. One of the researchers I talked to gave me a great quote. He said that relationships in ecology are much more important than identity. And so if you need a large predator, or there's another example on Mauritius where they had lost all their large fruit-eating animals, which really had a negative effect, and then they brought in some exotic fruit-eating tortoises, and that seemed to work very well to help restore native plants in Mauritius. So this researcher, Dennis Hansen, says, relationships are more important than identity. If you need a big fruit eater or a big predator, it's better to plug one in from somewhere else than to struggle along with nothing at all.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to talk with me, and maybe once in future giants will help people think about these relationships in ecology versus the identity.
Yeah, I hope so, and thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Sharon Levy about Once and Future Giants, what ice age extinctions tell us about the fate of Earth's largest mammals.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.